Welcome to Equestrian Movement's First Do No Harm podcast. I'm your host, Katie Boniface, co-founder of Equestrian Movement with Sarah Gallagher. We work with horse riders who want to build a stronger bond and a deeper connection with their horses. In our First Do No Harm podcast, we discuss with other industry professionals how to work with horses to firstly do no harm and secondly support their mental, emotional and physical well-being throughout the training process, so that we have horses that enjoy learning and ask to be ridden. Each episode, we discuss the different influences our training can have and how we can improve our horses' overall athleticism, soundness of mind and body, and emotional fortitude, while strengthening and deepening our relationship with our horses. Each week, I will endeavour to bring to you a new episode on horse riding, training, handling and husbandry, or an interview with other industry professionals to help you address where and why you might get stuck in creating the beautiful union of dancing souls that is the equestrian sport. Are you ready to kick off today's show? Let's get started. Hey team, Katie here from Equestrian Movement, and today I'm so excited to introduce you to Dr. Andrew McLean, who is the co-director of Equitation Science International. Andrew is the winner of the Eureka Prize for Science. He is in great demand as a trainer, coach, and speaker. In addition to establishing the Equine Behaviour Centre in Australia, he has written 6 books, including an international bestseller, and authored over 55 peer-reviewed journal articles. An accredited coach for more than 50 years, Andrew's own riding achievements include being the winner of the advanced section of the famous Gawler 3-day event, representing Australia in horse trials, shortlisted for the World Championships, competitor at state and national events in FEI level dressage and eventing, show jumping to Grand Prix level. He also held a race horse owner trainer license and raced bareback in Australia and New Zealand in the 1970s and 80s. In this first episode, we will go more into Andrew's roots, where he shares us how he started out as a horse rider as a child and how that has blossomed into his love and care for horses. The mission at Equitation Science International is to educate horse riders and handlers in equitation science to enable efficiency and safety in all horse interactions. And as you hear Andrew and his discussion about his passion for the horses and their welfare, as well as delving a little bit into his work with the elements, you can hear that concern for the horse and rider's welfare shine through. So without further ado, let's kick off today's show. Hi, Andrew. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast. Could you start by introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks very much. I'm really pleased to be here. Well, I guess I've gone through many phases in my life, but all of them centered around my interest in animals and animals' way of understanding the world and moving and all of those sorts of things, and then particularly horses, because I grew up in a very horsey family. My mother was a well-known horse rider and generally just a very good trainer. She trained race horses and won races and so all sorts of things like that. And then we moved to King Island when I was a teenager, and that was fantastic because there was so much life there. And we rode our horses bareback and chased kangaroos and caught snakes and did all sorts of things. So it was a fascination for those things that led me down this path. And then that led me to do a degree in science, and I majored in zoology. And I was teaching, I was very lucky, I got a job back at the university teaching zoology and various other aspects of physiology and genetics. When I was very young, I was only 21, and as I was doing that, animal behaviour became increasingly interesting to me, you know, why animals do the things they do, because on the one hand, and I was riding at a high level by that time, and also on the one hand, in eventing and show jumping, I had trainers telling me to do things that actually worked. Of course, it was really good, but I didn't see how it intersected with what I was learning and teaching in zoology. And so I started to explore how that could be synchronized. And I realized that there was a really big gap in our understanding about how training works, and nobody had ever explored it. There was no literature. So I decided to go further and really get into it because I really wanted to make my event horses do better. It wasn't so much of a welfare-driven thing as it is now for me, but I just wanted to train them better so I could go to Europe with my horse and win badminton or something like that. And in the end, I won Gawler three-day event, the advanced section. That was fantastic. But also, interestingly, I don't think I was much of a competitor. When I won that three-day event, I had a kind of a heavy feeling of it really wasn't as great. I thought my life would be very different, but it actually was just no different. And I continued on doing it, but I slowly lost a bit of interest in competing at the top level. And I had a very good stallion. There was a thoroughbred that I didn't own him in the beginning. He was just sent to me with three others as weanlings to a gist. So we lived in Tasmania at that time, to a gist. And then I was going to break them in because I'd started breaking in, and I really loved the method, the Jeffrey method. It was just so sensible and calm and gentle. And when I got to know this horse here, I just couldn't believe how well he moved. And so the long and short was the owner wouldn't let me buy him because he had to race. And so in the end, he had to go racing. So he went racing. I raced him myself, but I didn't win any races with him. And the owner thought, that's probably because I'm a really lousy racehorse trainer. It's probably true, but I did my best. But then he also went to a very good trainer called Michael Trinder, who is one of our best trainers in Tasmania. And he said to me, this is a distance horse. This horse can't sprint. And all the races for young horses were sprinting. So the owner ended up selling him to me for the price of just breaking in one horse, which in those days was $300. So that was him, and he got to the top very fast. He was super good at dressage and even broke a couple of records. I think it was the first horse to get 80% in Northern Victoria Dressage Association, and was marvellous in cross-country and all aspects of eventing. And so I was offered a big price for him, and we had just moved to Victoria from Tasmania with no money, pretty much. And so this horse, he was a first horse in the country to be sold in performance sports for $100,000. We sold him to Tim Collins in England, which was really tough to do, but it did help us get a good start and build the Australian Equine Behaviour Centre. And at that time, I was enrolled in my PhD, which certainly helped this horse because I began to understand what I was doing. And he was just such a dream. He did all of his three-day events in a snaffle. He got to advanced in just 12 outings of leaving home, and he kept winning his way up, always in a snaffle. He had the best brakes. You could shorten him just on a piece of cotton. I could ride him bareback as well with just a head collar. He was a lovely guy and still is. Then he went and I developed the Australian Equine Behaviour Centre, and that's history. So that's really what we did for many years at the Australian Equine Behaviour Centre. We broke in horses and we retrained many horses. I also went around the country running clinics in every state in Australia. There was a massive learning curve on how I could apply this information that I was learning my PhD to improve horses. And it was just so ultimately safe and really successful. I was riding more horses at rear than anybody in the country in those, I'm pretty sure, in the period of time between 1990 and 2015. And I started to go overseas doing it too. So I was doing it in North America, from Missouri up to Minnesota, parts of Canada, Alberta, and in Europe, Finland and England. And also, it just got really out of control. I was always on the road, but I was learning so much and refining what I do. And it started to make me think that I needed to put this into, you know, a kind of course that people could understand and take it step by step and learn all the aspects of training, because so there's so much, like, so many glass ceilings in horse training. There's so much jargon and narrative that you never, and people capitalize that and say, you know, they love the jargon. But it's not simple, and it should be simple, because horses operate in, it's quite simple to understand how they do operate. And it's important to recognize the step-by-step training that you've got to do just to make it obvious for the horse to know, you know, this is the likely answer to that question because he's already learned something similar previously. So that's not quite a nutshell, but that's pretty much what happened. And so I began to write books. I mean, I've done about 12 books now because I've also taken this to Asia in 5 countries there, and I train elephants in a very similar way, and it's equally as successful there, and it makes mahouts' lives really safe, and they love it because it is, again, simple, and it's not loaded with the narratives that elephant training normally is. So yeah, it's been a really blessed kind of journey for me to have those opportunities to do all of this with animals.
So good. I did one of my projects in, I think maybe like grade 7 or something on you.
When did you?
Yeah. And your career. But yeah, I love that story. I love that journey. And I love the work that you're doing. I don't know how long ago it was. It was definitely a good couple of years. I think I read one of your stories about administering eye drops to an elephant through clicker training. And I was like, oh, shoot, like I'm missing something really important, you know, because I've like come through that trajectory of like what the industry looks like, you know, in like standard how you experienced it without the application of the zoology and the animal behavior. And, you know, it really can become about trying to manhandle the horses into submission, which is really ineffective and just makes it very difficult and complicated and almost dangerous to work with. So this idea of being able to have an elephant, you know, accepting eye drops without having to you're not manhandling an elephant.
No, and actually before that started, when I went there to observe, because I always start off by observing what they do and how they do it in the beginning, because there's a lot of good things I can learn from that, because I do try and keep it culturally sensitive. So I use the words they use in the various languages where they have elephants in Thai or India, could be Assamese or Malayalam or whatever, and Laos and Nepal. And I use those terms. But what I see is that with the elephants, this particular one that they needed eye drops, they just tie him up to a really strong crush. But it's a big male elephant that weighs 3.5 tons, and he's nearly pulling the crush out of the ground. And it's, you know, he's really distressed. So within 15 minutes, I showed that with clicker training, you can actually do this. It's so much easier with counter conditioning. It's an amazing technique. And there are so many of these techniques that arise from understanding about animals. It just makes your life safe. And we do need that, because not only is elephant training immensely dangerous, the death rate of mahouts is really high and it remains so, but also in horse training and our interactions with horses, the serious injury rate is something like one serious injury for every 350 hours of contact. And that's 20 times higher than motorcycling. So, you know, we could do a lot better. And that's another motivation for me to do that. And one of the things I'm really pleased about for my life in using these techniques is that I've been a very engaged kind of horse trainer. I've ridden difficult horses, you know, as I mentioned, 3 times a year in every state of Australia. I've ridden them all throughout Europe, horses that rear and buck and shy and whatever. But I found there's so many better ways to do that, that now at my age now, I'm 69 and I don't have a lame bone in my body. You know, I'm completely sound. I don't have a bad back. I don't walk with a limp. I can run. I do sports still. I still do this sport called triathlon, where you run and swim and shoot. And that's because science helped make my work with animals easy. And it made it so much better welfare for the animals.
That I think that's such an important and valuable take home tool. It's something that, you know, developing a healthy respect for the size and the ability of the animal without a fear is such a big challenge. But there are so many people who lose, you know, access to horses in their career because of an injury. There is a lot of risk in the sport, and trying to like teach the students as they come through, you know, like I work with a lot of beginners, there's an expectation and a push to go fast and jump high, and just like trying to rein that in and be like, hey, how about we pay attention to our horse and make sure that they're on board with our training so that we like limit the risk of what we're doing. It's such a juggling act. So to get, you know, through your career so healthy, it's rare, honestly. Like there's so many people with significant injuries as they get older.
Yeah, I met horse breakers who haven't yet broken in as many as I have, and they're maybe 45 and they've been badly injured. And it's not like I haven't had some. I've had a few. I've been lucky, I suppose, too. So I broke a couple of spinous processes in learning about horses that flip over rather than, you know, because that's a really dangerous thing to get on. A horse that just freezes and then flips over in the back. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that on the horse. But yeah, it is important to get to know. And that's really why I was interested to get involved in Pony Club Australia and help design the new syllabus. And it's had quite a lot of pushback because it is a little different approach, but it's the same outcomes and in many ways the same pathways and threads to get there. It just teaches children why you do this and how it works. And therefore, when you know why and how, you can do everything so much better, and you can apply it in new situations. You know, you can, it's a tool that you can say, oh, well, maybe I will, you know, that's the reason the horse is doing that is because basically he's running. You know, for example, when you're even dealing with horses for injections, we sort of humanistically apply all sorts of terms to the horse. You know, there's, you know, he's terrified and chicken hearted and all those things, and he's running away, but essentially what he's doing, his legs are moving and he's running forward. So we need to identify that and teach him to stand still and then maybe make the step-by-step for the injection through various techniques like the counter conditioning, make it easy for him. But I really do. I understand the motivation and excitement of children because King Island, we had our first team for Pony Club trials. And in those days, the Pony Club trials in King Island's part of Tasmania, they were at a metre 10 and there was nothing in between. There was no early grades. You just started off at that if you wanted to do the Pony Club trials for your Pony Club. And so we sent a team over and we had never really done that. We jumped fences around the country chasing kangaroos. So we basically, you know, if your horse can jump a 44-gallon drum with a rail on it, you're off and running. And so we would do that even without, you know, training all the early steps, but it wasn't pretty and it often went badly. And some horses never really became good jumpers. So everything makes sense, like teaching children to read, you know, doing it in a really step-by-step way is such a better way to go because in a way less is more. You know, you can get a better outcome if you just spend time doing a bit and consolidating. And in the end, the goal of the journey actually comes closer.
Yeah, so true. I like just going back on, you know, working with pony clubs and whatnot. I think we're just like going to have to work so hard to break that culture of push them through it and make them do it because it's just so ingrained in that like trajectory of how we've learned and what we've been doing. You know, when I go down and teach at the Pony Club, we've got one of our trainings that's called Confidence Through Curiosity with like getting the horses to target things. And you can see like the looks on the mum's faces when they see the things that I'm bringing out for the horses to target, like I'm about to pancake their children or something. And just like, you know, instilling curiosity in the horse to investigate something instead of being scared of it can just totally flip their interaction with the way that they work with things. But like that idea of desensitization is so ingrained into them that, you know, the horses come out and they're really curious and they get involved and they really engage in these like terrifying objects. And then at the end of the lesson, you know, the kids are so excited about how well their horse is doing it. And then they just started throwing the balls at the horses. And I'm like, no, like, we just worked so hard to build your horse's trust and confidence in you. And now you're going to start throwing these objects at the horses. And it's like, this is not how it works.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really good to teach children that, you know, the step-by-step from the horse's perspective rather than just throw them in the deep end. And I think that's pretty characteristic of what's missing in most equestrian curricula, you know, that they, it's not really addressed everything clearly step-by-step.
So I have your Volume 1 First Principles of Modern Horse Training here, and I would just love to go over some of the things that you talk about in it. We will have the links in the show notes to this book. It is such a beautiful guideline of just like, you know, what you're talking about with those easy to apply principles. You can see how, like, with the right mindset and learning this, that you could really, you know, get quite a long way just with this book alone. One of the things that I'd like you to go into a little bit for me is how horses are good at learning by association.
Yeah, I mean, that is their chief feature. They are just brilliant at associative learning. In fact, I think we would be too, but we have far too much, you know, self-talk going on, you know, in our own heads, and we can't really be in the moment as easily unless we pay for it and do yoga and Zen and things like that, because there's always, you know, that little nagging voice in your head, and we're not as observant as horses by and large. And the associative learning is all about from the abilities in classical conditioning where they notice anything that comes before, so what we call a Pavlovian association, anything that comes regularly before something else that is important to them that they notice, and it could be something that they want, like food or an aid or anything, they begin to associate it and they start learning that's a trigger. And so there are so many triggers that they do learn that we don't even intend them to learn. A simple trigger is if you drive to the paddock to feed the horse with your car, they don't initially know the car's got anything to do with it. Very soon they start chaining it all backwards, and they notice that because you get out and you get the bucket from the boot and then you turn, tip the bucket in the feed bin, they start chaining that all backwards to the point where they can hear your car coming from a distance. And that's all classical conditioning. It's also involved in the use of, in the way we train the aids, because the light aid of the rider's legs and rein should always come before any stronger use. And the horse soon learns, I can avoid that strong pressure by giving the response earlier during the light aid. And that is the art to really riding, you know, light. And then the other part of associative learning is the operant conditioning part. And that's probably the deepest part of all horse training. It's, you know, it's really the kind of the nuts and bolts of it. And that's or otherwise known as trial and error learning, and they are brilliant at that. So, for example, if a pony is in his yard and he learns to fiddle with the latch, or he doesn't just learn it, he might just play with it and fiddles with the latch, but suddenly the gate opens and he gets out, he's now rewarded by freedom, and maybe he even gets food nearby. Maybe he even gets company with other horses. But all of those things are, these are primary reinforcers, those things, and they reward the behavior. So he remembers the fiddling with a latch. He might not remember the exact sequence of maneuvers, but he soon will, because as he gets better at fiddling with the latch, it gets faster and faster. And soon he just opens the latch and gets out, and may even learn to open the latches of other horses and let them out too. And this is a very clever behavior, but it isn't reasoning, it's actually operant conditioning, trial and error learning. They're so darn good at it. And so when we teach horses in two ways, we can use positive reinforcement, which is, you know, we can use food, a food treat, or we can use wither scratching. And there's ample data on both. Some of the people who advocate sole primary reinforcement with food disagree about tactile reinforcement, but there is literature on the use of that. And I think the good thing about tactile reinforcement is that you can't have too much of it and they don't become frisking you for it. So I think we need to use both. You know, I think I see these as just tools in our toolbox. Food's really valuable, but so is tactile reinforcement. And on the other side of the coin, we have the trial and error learning of the aids of pressure. And so when we first have the horse in a head collar and we give him a bit of pressure forward from the head collar, that's uncomfortable. And the horse may decide then to step forward, and then the pressure goes away. And so through trial and error, he's learned to remove the pressure. And that's what we want. That's how a dog learns to lead as well. And any animal, camels, all of them, elephants learn. You know, we tap them with a stick on the hindquarters to go to move forward. And it's a very gentle tap if they've been trained correctly. And they learn to move forward and it becomes a habit. And we add a voice command by classical conditioning again, by putting the voice command before the movement. And so the animals learn very quickly through these pressure and release. We do the pressure and release with the bit. You know, when the horse is first broken in, we put pressure with our reins and the pressure goes onto the horse's mouth. But the moment he slows or does anything, we immediately release the pressure. And we can augment that with wither scratching to make him even keener, you know, to amplify the reward, or we can even augment it with food rewards, whatever people choose to do. Many people augment it just purely voice praise, but the big thing is the release of pressure. So I always say to people, it's not the pressure that trains an animal to do anything. That motivates. It's really the release of pressure. And the minutiae of the release of pressure is absolutely massive. It's so important to be exactly on time. I notice that when you're training a horse to go into the horse trailer, if the use of the rope, the bum rope or tapping or lead pressure, whatever you do, if that's not released exactly when the horse gives a single step forward as he's giving it, he won't learn it because he doesn't see the point. So timing is everything. And that's why all the top trainers that I've ever seen, and in this country we have some pretty amazing trainers. We've got people who train in all sorts of different ways. Steve Jeffries and Guy McLean, many people who are just amazing, including many, you know, the Olympic level riders as well who teach people. The characteristic of all of them is actually excellent timing. And that's what we have to really teach people, I think. So yes, associative learning is fundamental, and breaking it down into how we train in the beginning, in hand, what do we want to do with, what are our goals? You know, we want the horse to not only go, but to stop. We want him to be able to go faster and slower, to go sideways and to turn his hindquarters sideways, to turn his front legs sideways, to lower his head. All of these things, they're all done through associative learning, and there are step-by-step levels throughout them all. Under saddle, we want exactly the same things, all those maneuvers. Plus, we want gait changes, you know, walk, trot, canter, gallop, including downwards ones. And all of these initially are learned through the associative learning. And then they're captured by classical conditioning of the rider's seat and body, or else or voice, but certainly by the light aid that is associated with every single one of them, the light aid of the reins for slowing. So it's been pretty interesting because in my life, I've done a lot of experiments with this, using rein tensiometry and pressures under the rider's legs. And in Europe, I particularly remember doing a workshop. I did a series of workshops over many years at Rotterdam, and I had Olympic level riders. I did quite a lot with the Dutch team in the early days, and it was amazing that they would say to me, we don't use our reins, we use our seat. And I said, no, your reins are part of it, because I know that because one of my PhD students showed that when top riders think they're only using their seat to stop a horse because their hand's so still, there's still a rein spike when you look at the results from the tensiometry, from the in rein tension meters. So I had this in the back of my mind. So I said, no, there's always a rein spike, because you see the seat When you stop the horse, we forget that under our own backsides is saddle, there's flock or air, there's saddle cloth. So that's a pretty deep interface to reach a horse with a clear message. And I'm not saying it doesn't work, it does, but it's kind of really obscure compared to the merest touch of the rein. And so if you show people, say, okay, have a loose rein, now show me how you stop the horse with your seat. Well, the horse often will stop in the first repetition, but I said, do four more. And when they, each one of the four subsequent ones without any reins at all, like the reins have got to be looped, the horse loses the learned response and starts to stop more poorly. You know, it takes more steps. So it just shows that the seat is a really great adjunct, but with the lightest possible rein aids. And that's why we still have contact and still have a connection with the horse. And that's why our legs, you know, aren't doing anything when we're not asking for anything. But when we ask for something, we may use our seat, but our leg's part of it. We call these compound aids, in the compound signals in experimental psychology, but they're really an important part. That's why horse riding is difficult, because top riders really good at doing compound signals, but the rest of us have to learn it. And my job has been, because I've been at that level, is to break it down and say, yeah, but this is what they do. This is how you can get there. Maybe not everyone can. You know, there's a lot of skill to be that good, but yeah. It smashes the glass ceiling if at least people know the recipe. That's my belief.
So good. It's definitely, you know, working a lot with beginners to intermediate riders, balance and body awareness and body control is such a critical foundational step that gets skipped. I think, like, you know, as riding school starting students, we really need to take responsibility for not how quickly we can get them into a group to, you know, make the school viable financially, but, like, you know, as a career of horse riders, being able to find stability and balance in the saddle so that you're not finding it on the horse's mouth is essential to progress. And such a difficult skill set to master in the beginning. Like, we spend so long at the halt, just like standing up, finding your balance over your leg and then sitting gently. And then I'll get them to do maybe like two strides of trot and their like legs fly forward. It takes like a good 6 to 12 months to get that stability of the lower leg. And then once they've got that, they've got to figure out how to rotate through the upper body to be able to get into the turn. So it's like, yeah, I've got my lower leg stable. Now I have to, how do I move my body and keep my leg still? And all of those, like, you know, imbalances that we do in the horse, how does the horse tease apart a movement that we've done because we've lost our balance and caught our balance? Like, you might catch your balance with your leg and accidentally put your leg on, or catch your balance with your hand and accidentally smack them in the mouth with the bit. Like, how are they going to tease apart an accidental cue from our body from like an actual cue that we're trying to get them to respond to? It's like, just the trajectory of learning from the get-go is so challenging and requires a lot of refinement and returning to those foundations.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, because I'm really interested in the development of these compound aids, and that includes the rider's body, because there's so much that can go wrong, in the sense that, you know, you teach the horse the basics of stop and go with the reins. That's a pretty much a fundamental given in all horse sports. And that's what horse breakers do. They teach that sort of thing to horses, that reins and legs for turning, you know, stop and go and turn basically and yield the hindquarters. But nonetheless, associated with all of those things while we're doing it is something we do with our body in balance. And the horse is so good at classical conditioning that the horse begins very quickly to learn, oh, this is associated with that. But actually, no, it's not. You weren't meant to do that. You're not meant to be leaning on your left seat bone. You know, there's so much we've got to teach the horse while we're doing these things. So the very beginning of it, I see that there's a possibility of developing this in a sequential way, that in the beginning, when the horse is just learning the basics of stop and go from the legs and reins, you know, as fundamental aspects of trial and error learning or associative learning, it doesn't really matter what you do with your body there, because these pressures might be a little bit louder. But after a while, when the horse is operating from light aids, it's really important to do that and to get good instruction on body control and consistency, because otherwise it just distorts the aids, you know, and it may even oppose them. You know, people might be giving with their seat an aid that is actually associated with slowing when they want the horse to accelerate. And that can be the start of the lazy horse. They might be doing the opposite and giving the horse a speed up cue when they want to use the reins. And now the horse is becoming heavy in the reins because he wants to go. There are so many aspects to that. And that's the art of a really good teacher. You know, to be honest, that's not my best skill, but other people like you are really good at that. My wife is really especially good at that sort of thing. My chief interest has always been developing the understanding of the fundamental primacy of the rein aids for basically 10 things: down a gate, slower within the gate, shorter within the gate, turning left or right with the opening rein, turning left or right with a closing rein, that's an indirect rein as opposed to a direct rein, and yielding the hindquarters. And all of those basic responses are important for the horse to learn, and I think as the horse's alphabet. And this is true in hand and under saddle, we need to teach them all of those things. And that's on that basis you can build anything. And that's really why my interest is not in methods. I'm interested in all the different methods that are around the world, but I'm really not critical of them. I used to be, but I've had to mature and grow up and learn that it's a big world and we all have a space. And then the next part of that education for me was learning to appreciate the good things there and incorporate them, but also to have a dialogue with people. You can say, yeah, well, there's another way to do this too, and there may be some better ways. There might be easier ways for the horse to learn this. And, you know, that's what we should all do, I think. Often people get so protective of their patch. Mm. And I think also the more nervous they are about, or the more insecure the people are about their own methodologies, if they're not shrouded in a narrative that seems protective, if there's a few holes in the narrative, then they feel even more insecure and they protect it even harder. But we shouldn't. We should really be having these big discussions because it's complicated.
That's it from us for today. Thank you for listening to the show. We will have all the links to the books and programs and how you can follow along with Andrew's work further in the show notes below. Look forward to talking again next week when we continue to dig into the training theory that Andrew shares throughout his books. If you're starting to realize that escalating pressure and having pressure release is the only tool in your toolkit inevitably results in conflict and manhandling your 500 kilo plus fur baby, you have to check out our free masterclass, Say Yes to a Happy Willing Horse. There is an art and a science to everything we do with our horses. The science is the undeniable behavioral training and manipulation of the internal chemistry, neurotransmitters and hormones. Hello, dopamine. The art is in the connection and the relationship. How your horse behaves is a reflection of who they are in relationship to you, how they receive your instruction, and how safe you make them feel to follow your lead. And if you didn't want that, ride a motorbike. We know that our horses are emotive, intelligent, sentient beings that are aware of the manipulative, coercive, and sometimes abusive tactics used to force them to cooperate. And we can seek a better way. The foundations of holistic horse handling are nervous system regulation, compassionate leadership, communication, and emotional agility. These elements are critical to have a handle on before going to work with your horse, so that we can develop the psychological safety for the horse to communicate how the training can be of benefit to them. Our training should be happening for them, not to them. If we want a horse that we can have trust and confidence in and that seeks to look after us first, we need to create an environment where learning is fun, movement feels good, and our horses ask to be ridden. This sounds impossible to you, know that it's not. It's a reality hundreds of our students have achieved. It just requires coming home and a relearning of what we lost due to peers, coaches, trainers, and other influences teaching us that that kind of softness and kindness creates unsafe horses. In truth, it is the opposite. To create safe, willing horses, we first need to create a felt sense of safety and a felt sense of belonging. We need to be strategic and intentional how we set the horse up for success so as not to overface ourselves and our horses, and we need to create experiences where we build trust and confidence in each other. If you're ready for your horsemanship and horse riding to look like this, take the first step, click on the link in the show notes, and join us in our free masterclass, Say Yes to a Happy Willing Horse. Or you can find it over on our website at www.equestrianmovement.com/say yes. Until next week, happy trails.